Don't you get that? Did you ever stop for 1 minute to think that I might not want you to die? Or how it would make me feel? No, because it's not about me or your mom. This is all about you and how you'll feel. She took a step backward. And to think you lied about it, she whispered.
I didn't lie. A lie of omission, she said, her voice bitter.
You lied because you knew I wouldn't agree with you. That I might walk away from someone who was willing to do something so wrong. And why? Because you wanted to sleep with me? Because you wanted to have a good time?
No.
Luke's protest sounded weak to her ears. She could feel hot tears spilling down her cheeks, beyond her control.
I just can't handle this right now. Not this, too. It was a terrible week, all the girls talking and Marcia avoiding me. I needed you this week. I needed someone to talk to. But I understood that you needed to ride. I accepted it because it was your job. But now, knowing that the only reason you were gone was because you were off trying to kill yourself?
The words came out in a rush, almost as fast as her mind was racing, and she turned, reaching over and grabbing her purse. She couldn't be here. Not with him. Not now.
I can't take this.
Wait.
Don't talk to me,
she said.
I don't want to hear you try to explain why it's so important for you to die.
I'm not going to die.
Yes, you are. I may not have been around long enough to know, but your mom has. And the doctors have. And you know what you're doing is wrong.
Her breaths were coming fast.
When you come to your senses, then we can talk. But until then...
She didn't finish. Instead, flinging her purse over her shoulder, she stormed out of the house and ran to her car. After throwing it in gear, she almost backed into the porch as she turned it around and hit the accelerator hard, barely able to see through the blur of her tears. Sophia was numb. Luke had called twice since she returned to the sorority house, but she didn't answer. She sat in the room alone, knowing that Marcia was with Brian but somehow missing her nonetheless. Since their argument, Marcia had spent every night at Brian's, but Sophia suspected it had less to do with Brian than the fact that Marcia felt too ashamed to face her. She was still angry with Marcia. What she'd done was pretty crappy, and Sophia couldn't simply pretend it didn't bother her. A best friend didn't start dating an ex. Call it a cardinal rule or whatever, but friends just didn't do that to each other. Ever. But even though part of Sophia thought she should have told Marcia that their friendship was over, she hadn't been able to say the words, because in her heart she knew that Marcia hadn't done it on purpose. She hadn't schemed or plotted or purposely tried to hurt her. Marcia just wasn't wired that way, and Sophia knew firsthand how charming Brian could be when he put his mind to it, which she suspected he probably had, because Brian was wired that way. Brian had known exactly what he was doing, and she had no doubt that dating Marcia was his way of trying to get back at her. He wanted to hurt her one last time by destroying her relationship with Marcia. And then, no doubt, he'd hurt Marcia, too. Marcia would end up learning the hard way what kind of guy Brian actually was. After that, she'd feel even worse than she was probably feeling right now. In a way, it would serve her right. And yet... But now, Sophia wanted to talk to Marcia. Right now, she really needed her. To talk about Luke. And just to talk, period. Like her sisters were doing downstairs and in the hallway. She could hear the sound of their voices drifting through the door. She didn't want to be anywhere near them, though, because even if they said nothing, their expressions were plenty eloquent. Lately, every time she entered the house, the rooms and hallways would go quiet, and she could intuit exactly what each of them was thinking and wondering.
How do you think she feels? I hear that she and Marcia never see each other anymore. I feel bad for her. I can't imagine what she's going through.
She couldn't face that right now, and despite everything, she found herself wishing that Marcia were there. Because right now, she was sure she'd never felt more alone. The hours passed. Outside, the sky slowly filled with wintry clouds, backlit by the silver glow of the moon. As Sophia lay on her bed, she remembered the evenings on which she and Luke had watched the sky. She remembered the horseback rides and making love, the dinners with his mom. She recalled in vivid detail how they'd sat in lawn chairs in the bed of his truck on the first night they met. Why would he risk dying? As much as she tried, she couldn't understand it. She knew it was more about his guilt than anything else, but was it worth risking his life? She didn't think so, and she knew his mother didn't. But he seemed intent on sacrificing himself anyway. That's what she couldn't grasp, and when he called a third time, she still couldn't bring herself to answer. It was getting late, and the house had slowly but surely begun to quiet. Sophia was exhausted, yet she knew she wouldn't be able to sleep. As she tried to make sense of Luke's self-destructive path, she found herself wondering exactly what had happened on the night he'd first encountered Big Ugly Critter. He'd told her about the plate in his head, but she had the sense now that it had been even worse than that. Slowly, she crawled out of bed, making for the laptop on her desk. With equal parts foreboding and the urge to finally know everything, she typed his name into the search engine. She wasn't surprised that there were quite a few listings, including a short bio on Wikipedia. He had, after all, been one of the top-ranked writers in the world. But she wasn't interested in a biography. Instead, she added the words Big Ugly Critter after his name and pressed the search button. Instantly, a link to a video on YouTube appeared at the top of the screen. Before she lost her nerve, she pressed the button, watching anxiously as the YouTube screen came up. The video was just shy of 2 minutes, and she saw with a sickening feeling that it had been viewed by over 500,000 people. She wasn't sure she wanted to watch, but she hit play nonetheless. As soon as it began, it took only a second to recognize Luke in the chute on top of the bull, the camera angled on him from somewhere above, obviously for the television audience. The stands were filled to capacity, and behind the chute there were signs and banners lining the arena wall. Unlike the McLeansville venue, this arena was indoors, which meant it was probably used for everything from basketball games to concerts. Luke wore jeans and a long-sleeved red shirt under a protective vest along with his hat. The number 16 was embroidered on his vest. She watched Luke adjust the wrap while other cowboys tried to tighten the rope beneath the bull. He pounded on his fist, then squeezed his legs, adjusting his position again. The announcers talked over the action in heavy twangs.
Luke Collins has finished third overall in the PBR World Standings and is considered one of the best riders in the world, but this is a bull he's never ridden before.
Not many have, Clint. Big Ugly Critter has only been ridden twice, and he was the PBR World Champion Bucking Bull last year. He's strong and mean, and if Luke can stay on, he's just about assured of getting a score in the 90s. He's getting ready.
By then, Luke had grown strangely still, but the pause lasted only an instant. She watched the gate swing open and heard the roar of the crowd. The bull came out hard, bucking, his rear legs pistoning into the air, his head pitched low to the ground. He half-spun toward the left, kicking hard again, then literally jumped, all four legs coming off the ground, before suddenly beginning to spin in the opposite direction. By then, 4 seconds had gone by, and Sophia heard the crowd go berserk.
"He's doing it!"
one of the announcers shouted. It was at that instant that Sophia saw Luke jerk forward, his body off balance, just as the bull's head exploded backward. The impact was horrific. Luke's head rocketed in the opposite direction, as if devoid of any muscle at all.
"Oh, my!"
Luke's body went suddenly limp as he toppled off the bull, his hand still tethered to the wrap. But the bull appeared psychotic with rage, an animal out of control, and the bucking continued, fierce and unrelenting. Luke bobbed up and down like a rag doll, whipped in every direction. When the bull began to spin again, Luke followed in sickening motion, his feet skimming the ground like a whirligig. By then, the bullfighters and others had jumped into the ring, trying desperately to free Luke's grip, but the bull just wouldn't stop. He stopped spinning and charged at the new intruders, swinging his horns wildly, tossing one of the bullfighters aside as if he were weightless. Another tried and failed to free Luke's wrist from the wrap. Another few seconds passed before a bullfighter was able to jump up and hold on long enough, while running with the bull, to free Luke's hand. As soon as it happened, Luke toppled to the dirt and lay on his stomach, his head to the side, unmoving, while the bullfighter scurried away.
"He's hurt! They gotta get folks in here now!"
and still the bull wouldn't stop. Instead, as if realizing he was free of his rider, but angry that Luke had even attempted to sit astride him in the first place, the bull turned around, oblivious to the others who were trying to distract him. Lowering his head, he charged Luke, gouging his horns at Luke's prone figure with murderous intent. Two bullfighters jumped in, slapping and hitting, but the bull would not be denied. Instead, he kept swinging his massive horns at Luke's inert figure, then suddenly lunged forward atop Luke's body, where he began to buck again. No, not buck. Trample. And spin. In speechless terror, Sophia heard the announcer shout, "Get that bull off him!" Up and down, the enraged bull brought his hooves down with furious impact, crushing Luke beneath him, smashing down on his back, his legs, his head. His head. Five people circled the bull by then, doing everything they could to stop the rampage, but Big Ugly Critter continued his single-minded attack. Up and down, crushing Luke over and over. The announcer saying, "They gotta stop this!" The bull seemingly possessed. Until finally, he moved off of Luke and skittered sideways onto the dirt floor of the arena, still bucking wildly. The camera followed the bull as he continued to buck away and then zeroed in on Luke's prone figure, his face bloody and unrecognizable, as others began to attend to him. But by then, Sophia had covered her face, sobbing in horror and shock.
25. Luke. By Wednesday, Luke's headache had abated slightly, but he feared he wouldn't be well enough to compete in Macon, Georgia over the coming weekend. After that, the next event was in Florence, South Carolina, and he wondered whether he'd be in better condition by then. From there, the tour moved to Texas, and the last thing he wanted was to head into that stretch of the season with a serious physical handicap. Beyond that, he was beginning to worry about the expenses. Starting in February, the events required that he fly. It meant extra nights at the motels, extra meals, rental cars. In the past, when pursuing his dream, he'd viewed it as the cost of doing business. It still was, but now, with the loan repayment set to triple in 6 months, he'd found himself scouring the web for the cheapest flights he could find, most of which had to be booked weeks in advance. As best as he could estimate, his winnings from the first event would cover the cost of travel to the next 8 events. Which meant, of course, that not a dime would go toward meeting the upcoming loan payments. It wasn't about winning to chase a dream anymore. It was about winning regularly because he had to. Even as the thought entered his mind, however, he could hear Sophia's words contradicting him. That it wasn't about the ranch, or even about his mom. That it was all about the guilt he wanted to avoid. Was he being selfish? Until she'd said it, he'd never even considered the idea. It wasn't about him. He'd be fine. It was about his mom, her heritage, her survival at an age at which her options were few. He didn't want to ride. He was doing it because his mom had risked everything to save him, and he owed her. He couldn't watch her lose everything because of him. Otherwise, he'd feel guilty, which made it all about him. Or did it? He'd called Sophia 3 times on Sunday night, another 3 times on Monday, twice on Tuesday. He'd texted too, once each day, without receiving a response. He remembered how upset she'd been by Brian's stalking, which kept him from texting or calling on Wednesday. But by Thursday, he could take the silence no longer. He climbed into his truck and drove to Wake Forest, pulling to a stop in front of the sorority house. 2 identically dressed girls were sitting in the porch rockers, one of them talking on the phone, the other texting. Both glanced up briefly, then did a double take when they saw who was walking toward them. As he knocked, he could hear laughter drifting from inside. A moment later, the door was opened by a pretty brunette with 2 piercings in each ear.
"I'll tell Sophia you're here," was all she said, moving aside to let him in.
Off to the side, 3 girls sat on the couch, craning their necks to get a glimpse of him. He guessed they were the same girls he'd heard from outside the door, but now they simply gawked at him, the television blaring in the background as he stood in the foyer, feeling out of place. It was a couple of minutes before Sophia appeared at the top of the stairs, her arms crossed. She stared down at him, clearly debating what to do.
Then, sighing, she approached reluctantly. Noticing everyone's attention, she said nothing to him. Instead, she nodded toward the door. Luke followed her out. She didn't stop at the porch but walked down the sidewalk out of sight of those in the house before turning to face him.
"What do you want?"
she asked, her expression blank.
"I wanted to tell you that I'm sorry," Luke said, hands in his pockets, "for not telling you sooner."
"Okay," she said.
She added nothing, leaving him unsure what to say next. In the silence that followed, she turned away, studying the house across the street.
"I watched the video of your ride," she said, "on Big Ugly Critter."
He kicked at a few pebbles lodged in a crack in the sidewalk, afraid to face her.
"Like I said, it was pretty bad."
She shook her head.
"It was more than just pretty bad."
She turned to look at him, searching his face for answers.
"I knew it was dangerous, but I never thought that it was a matter of life and death. I guess I didn't really understand how much you risk every time you step into the ring. And that bull, and watching what he did to you, it was trying to kill you."
She swallowed, unable to finish. Luke, too, had watched the video once, 6 months after his ride. Back when he'd sworn he'd never ride again. Back when he'd felt lucky simply to have survived.
"You should have died, but you didn't," Sophia stated. "You were given a second chance. Somehow it was ordained that you should have the chance to live a normal life. And no matter what you say, I'll never understand why you'd want to risk that. It doesn't make sense to me. I told you once that I'd thought about killing myself, but that I never really meant it. I knew I'd never go through with it, but you, it's like you want to do it. And you'll keep going until you succeed."
"I don't want to die," he insisted.
"Then don't ride," she said, "because if you do, then I can't be part of your life. I'm not going to be able to pretend you're not trying to kill yourself, because I'd feel like I was condoning it somehow. I just can't do that."
Luke could feel his throat close up, making it difficult to speak.
"Are you saying you don't want to see me anymore?"
With his question, Sophia thought again about how much the tension had drained her, and she realized there were no tears left.
"I love you, Luke, but I can't be a part of this. I can't spend every minute that I'm with you wondering whether you'll live through the weekend. And I can't bear to imagine what it's going to be like if you don't."
"So it's over?"
"Yes," she said. "If you continue to ride, it's over."
The following day, Luke sat at his kitchen table, truck keys on the table. It was Friday afternoon, and if he left in the next few minutes, he'd reach the motel before midnight. His truck was already loaded with the gear he needed. His head still ached a little, but the real ache he felt was when he thought about Sophia. He wasn't looking forward to the drive or to the event. More than anything, he wanted to spend the weekend with Sophia. He wanted an excuse not to go. He wanted to take her horseback riding on the ranch, envelop her in his arms as they sat in front of the fire. Earlier he'd seen his mom, but their interaction remained strained. Like Sophia, she didn't want to talk to him. When work made it necessary to speak to him, her anger was palpable. He could feel the weight of her worries. About him, about the ranch, about the future. Reaching for the keys, he heaved himself out of the chair and started toward his truck, wondering if he'd be able to drive it back home. 26. Sophia.
"I thought you might be coming." Linda stood in the doorway of the farmhouse, her expression as weary and anxious as Sophia's own.
"I didn't know where else to go," Sophia said.
It was Saturday night, and they both knew that the man they adored would be in the ring tonight, risking his life, perhaps at this very moment. Linda waved her in and motioned for her to sit at the kitchen table.
"Would you like a cup of hot cocoa?" she asked. "I was just about to make myself one."
Sophia nodded, unable to say anything, and noticing Linda's cell phone lying on the table. Linda must have noticed Sophia staring at it.
"He texts me when he's finished," Linda said, busying herself at the stove. "He's always done that. Well, actually, he used to call. He'd tell me how well he did, good or bad, and we'd talk for a while. But now he..."
She shook her head.
He just texts to tell me that he's okay. And I can't do anything but sit here while I wait for it. Meanwhile, of course, time just slows down. Right now, I feel like I've been awake for a week. But even when I hear from him, I won't be able to sleep. Because I worry that even though he says he's okay, he's done something to further damage his brain. Sophia picked at the table with her fingernail.
He said he was in the ICU after the accident.
He was clinically dead when he arrived at the hospital, Linda said, stirring the heating milk slowly. Even after they revived him, no one thought he'd survive. The back of his skull was just shattered. Of course, I didn't know any of this at the time. I didn't get there until the following day, and when they brought me in to see him, I didn't even recognize him. The impact broke his nose and crushed his eye socket and his cheekbone. His face was swollen and just wrecked. They couldn't do anything about it because of the other damage. His head was wrapped up and he was bolted down so he couldn't move at all.
Linda took her time pouring the hot milk into the mugs, then spooned in the cocoa.
He didn't open his eyes for almost a week, and a few days after that they had to rush him back into surgery. He ended up spending almost a month in the ICU.
Sophia accepted a mug from Linda and took a tentative sip.
He said he has a plate.
He does, she said. A small one. But the doctor said the bones in his skull might never heal completely because some of the pieces just couldn't be salvaged. He said that it's like a stained glass window back there, everything barely holding together. I'm sure it's better now than it was even last summer, and he's always been a strong rider, but...
She trailed off, unable to finish the thought. Instead, she shook her head. After he was released from the ICU and they thought he could handle the trip, he was transported to Duke University Hospital. By then, I felt like we'd put the worst behind us because I knew he'd survive, maybe even recover fully. She sighed.
And then the bills started coming in, and I was looking at another 3 months at Duke just to allow his body to heal, and all the reconstructive surgery on his face. And, of course, he needed lots of rehab.
He told me about the ranch,
Sophia said softly.
I know, she said. It's how he justifies what he's doing.
It still doesn't justify it.
No,
Linda said.
It doesn't.
Do you think he's okay?
I don't know,
she said, tapping the phone.
I never know until he texts.
The next 2 hours passed in slow motion, elongated minutes stretching into eternity. Linda served up some slices of pie, but neither of them was hungry. Instead, they picked at the slices, waiting. And waiting. Somehow, Sophia thought that being here with Linda would reduce her anxiety, but if anything, she'd begun to feel worse. Seeing the video had been bad enough, but hearing about his injuries in detail made her almost nauseated.
Luke was going to die.
In her mind, there was no question about it. He would fall. The bull would swing his head the wrong way again. Or Luke would ride, but the bull would go after him as he was exiting the arena. He had no chance of survival, not if he kept riding. It was only a matter of time. She stayed lost in these thoughts until finally Linda's phone vibrated on the table. Linda lunged forward and read the message. Her shoulders suddenly relaxed and she let out a long breath. After sliding the phone to Sophia, she covered her face with her hands. Sophia glanced at the words. I'm okay and on my way home. 27. Luke. The fact that he didn't win in Macon wasn't a reflection of how well he rode, but rather a function of the quality of the bulls. The bulls' performances made up half of every score, after all, meaning that every event was left somewhat in the hands of the gods. His first bull was pretty much a flat spinner. Luke held on and the ride was no doubt exciting to the crowd, but when the scores came up, he found himself in ninth place. The second bull wasn't much better, but at least he managed to hold on while others ranked above him had been thrown, and he moved up to sixth. In the short go, he drew a decent bull, and he'd hopped off with a score good enough to move him into fourth place. It wasn't a stellar competition, but it was enough for him to retain, even extend, his lead in the overall points standings. He should have been pleased. With one more good weekend, he'd practically be guaranteed a place on the big tour, even if he rode poorly in the events that followed. Despite the lack of practice, despite the concussion, he was in just the position he'd wanted to be. Surprisingly, he didn't think that the rides had worsened his concussion. On the drive home, he kept waiting for his headache to intensify, but it didn't. Instead, it remained in low gear, a faint hum, nowhere close to the agony he'd felt earlier in the week. If anything, it seemed better than it had been this morning, and he had the sense that by morning it might even be gone. A good weekend, in other words. Everything was working out according to plan. Except, of course, for Sophia. He rolled home an hour before dawn and slept until almost noon. Only after his shower did he realize he hadn't reached for the painkillers. The headache, as he'd hoped, was gone. Nor was his body as sore as it had been after the first event. There were the usual aches in his lower back, but nothing he couldn't handle. After getting dressed, he saddled horse and went to check on the cattle. On Friday morning, before he'd left for Macon, he'd tended to a calf who'd had a run-in with some barbed wire, and he wanted to make sure it was healing properly. Sunday afternoon and Monday were spent working on the irrigation system, repairing leaks that had sprung up because of the cold weather. And beginning Tuesday morning, he tore off and then over the next 2 days, gradually replaced the shingles on his mom's roof. It was a good week, the work physical and straightforward, and by Friday he expected to feel a sense of accomplishment at everything he'd done. But he didn't. Instead, he ached for Sophia. He hadn't called or texted, nor had she, and her absence sometimes felt like a gaping hole where an essential limb used to be. He wanted things to go back to the way they were. He wanted to know that when he got home after the Florence event, he'd be able to spend the rest of the day with her. But even as he began laying out the belongings he would need on his trip to South Carolina, he knew that she would never reconcile herself to the choice that he had made. And unlike his mother, she could walk away. On Saturday afternoon, Luke stood watching the bulls behind the arena in Florence, South Carolina, and realized for the first time that his hands weren't shaking. Under ordinary circumstances, that should have been a good sign, since it meant that his nerves had calmed. Yet he couldn't escape the feeling that it had been a mistake to come here. He'd felt a heavy sense of dread as he'd pulled up an hour earlier, and since then, the nameless black thoughts in his head had only grown louder, whispers that urged him to get back into the truck and go home. Before it was too late. He hadn't felt like this in either Pensacola or Macon. Granted, he hadn't wanted to ride in those events any more than he wanted to ride in this one, but that was mainly because he wasn't sure he was ready to rejoin the circuit at all. But the dread he felt now was different. He wondered if Big Ugly Critter could sense it. The bull was here, in Florence, South Carolina, which made no more sense than it had in McLeansville last October. The bull didn't belong on this qualifying tour. He belonged with the big boys, where he'd no doubt be in the running to win another world champion bucking bull award. Luke couldn't figure out why the owner had consented to let him participate on the lower circuit. Most likely the promoter had made the owner a deal he couldn't refuse, in conjunction with one of the auto dealers in town. That had become more common on the circuit. Promotions like, "If you can ride him, you'll drive off in a new truck." While the crowd generally loved the added challenge, Luke would gladly excuse himself from that contest if he could. He wasn't close to being ready to ride him again, nor most likely was anyone else at the event. It wasn't the riding that was the concern, nor was it the prospect of being thrown. It was the way Big Ugly Critter might react afterward. He watched him for nearly an hour, thinking, "That bull shouldn't be here." And neither should he. The event began right on time, with the sun high enough to warm the day, if only slightly. In the stands, spectators were wearing jackets and gloves, and the lines for hot chocolate and coffee stretched nearly toward the entrance. As usual, Luke stayed in his truck, the heater blowing. He was surrounded by dozens of idling trucks in the parking lot, as his competitors tried to do the same. He ventured out once before his turn, as did a lot of the other competitors, to watch Trey Miller's attempt to ride Big Ugly Critter. As soon as the chute door opened, the bull ducked his head and launched into a twisting kick. Miller didn't have a prayer. When he landed, the bull turned just as he had after Luke's ride and rushed him head down. Luckily, Miller was able to make it to the arena fence in time to scramble away to safety.
The bull, as if aware how many people were watching him, stopped his charge and snorted hard. He stood in place, staring at the receding Miller, the cold air making it appear as though he were breathing smoke out of his nostrils. For his draw, Luke had pulled Raptor, a young bull with a short history on the tour. He was supposed to be an up-and-comer, and he didn't disappoint. He spun and bucked and jumped, but Luke felt strangely in control throughout, and by the end of the ride, he'd earned his highest score of the season. After he'd jumped down, the bull, unlike Big Ugly Critter, ignored him. There were more competitors at this third event of the season, making the wait between rides that much longer. For his second bull, Luke drew Locomotive, and though his ride wasn't as high-scoring as the first, he remained in the lead. Five rides later, Jake Harris had his turn on Big Ugly Critter. It didn't last long, but in a sense, he was either less or more lucky than Miller had been. He made it to the center of the arena before being thrown, and again, Big Ugly Critter turned and charged. There was nowhere to go. A younger rider might have been in trouble, but Harris was a veteran, and was able to dart out of the way at the last instant, the bull's horns missing him by inches. Two bullfighters jumped in to distract Big Ugly Critter, offering a temporary reprieve that allowed Harris to reach the arena wall. He launched himself upward and threw his legs over just as the angry bull closed in, ready to gore. Then, turning and squaring up, the bull set his sights on the bullfighters still in the arena. One made it to the safety of the arena fence, but the other had to hop into one of the barrels. Big Ugly Critter went after it, furious that his real prey had gotten away. He rammed the barrel, sending it careening across the arena, then rammed it again before pinning it against the wall, where he continued to savage it, swinging his horns and snorting, an animal gone insane. Luke watched, feeling sick to his stomach, thinking again that the bull did not belong at the event, or any event. One day soon, Big Ugly Critter was going to kill someone. After the first two rounds, 29 riders were on their way home. 15 remained. Luke was seated first in the championships round, the last rider of the day. There was a short break before the round started, and as the wintry sky darkened, the lights had been turned on. His hands remained steady. His nerves were in check. He was riding well, and if his day so far was any indication, he would ride well again. Which was strange, given how he'd felt at the beginning of the day. Nonetheless, the sense of dread he'd felt hadn't totally dissipated, despite his successful rides. If anything, it had grown worse since he'd seen Big Ugly Critter go after Harris. The event promoters should have been aware of the danger given the bull's history. They should have had five bullfighters in the ring, not just two. But even after Miller had ridden, they hadn't learned their lesson. The bull was dangerous. Psychotic, even. Like the other finalists, Luke lined up for the last draw of the day, and one by one he heard the bulls being assigned to the various riders. Raptor went third, Locomotive went seventh, and as the names continued, his sense of foreboding intensified. He couldn't look at the other competitors. Instead, he closed his eyes, waiting for the inevitable. And in the end, just as part of him had known would happen, he drew Big Ugly Critter. Time slowed down in the final round. The first two riders stayed on, the next three were tossed. It went back and forth on the next two. Luke sat in his truck listening to the announcer. His heartbeat began to speed up as adrenaline flooded his system. He tried to convince himself he was ready, that he was up to the challenge, but he wasn't. He hadn't been when he'd been at his peak, let alone now. He didn't want to go out there. He didn't want to hear the announcer mention the truck he could win, or the fact that the bull hadn't been ridden successfully in the last 3 years. He didn't want the announcer to tell the crowd that Big Ugly Critter was the bull who'd almost killed him, turning his potential ride into some sort of grudge match. Because it wasn't. He didn't hold a grudge against the bull. He was just an animal, albeit the craziest, meanest one he'd ever come across. He wondered whether he should simply withdraw. Take the scores from his first two rides and be done with it. He'd still finish in the top 10, maybe even the top 5, depending on how well the other riders did after all was said and done. He might drop in the overall rankings, but he'd remain in position to make the big tour, where Big Ugly Critter would surely end up. But what would happen the next time?
if he drew the bull in the first round? When he was in California, for instance, or Utah, after spending a small fortune on the flight and the motel and food, would he be prepared to walk away then, too? He didn't know. Right now, his mind was incoherent, filled with static, though when he glanced down, his hands were completely still. Odd, he thought, considering. In the distance, the roar of the crowd went up, signaling a successful ride. A good one from the sound of it. Good for him, Luke thought, whoever it was. These days, he begrudged no one his success. He, more than anyone, knew the risks. It was time. If he was going to go through with it, he had to make his decision. Stay or go. Ride or withdraw. Save the ranch, or let the bank take it away. Live or die. He drew a long breath. Hands still good. He was as ready as he'd ever be. Pushing open the door, he stepped onto the hard-packed dirt and gazed upward at the darkening winter sky. Live or die. That's what it all came down to. Steeling himself to the walk to the arena, he wondered which it would be.
Ira. When I wake, my first thought is that my body is weak and growing steadily weaker. Sleep, instead of giving me strength, has robbed me of some of the precious hours I have remaining. Morning sunlight slants through the window, reflected bright and sharp by the snow. It takes a moment to realize that it's Monday, more than 36 hours now since the accident. Who could have imagined such a thing happening to an old man like me? This will to live. But I've always been a survivor, a man who laughs in the face of death and spits in the eye of Mother Fate. I fear nothing, not even the pain. It's time for me to open the door and scale the embankment, to flag down a passing car. If no one comes to me, I will have to go to them. Who am I kidding? I can do no such thing. The agony is so intense that it takes a concerted effort to bring the world back into focus. For a moment, I feel strangely dissociated from my body. I can see myself propped on the steering wheel, my body a broken wreck. For the first time since the accident, I am sure that it is no longer possible for me to move. The bells are tolling, and I do not have long. This should frighten me, but it doesn't. In no small way, I have been waiting to die for the last 9 years. I was not meant to be alone. I am not good at it. The years since Ruth's passing have ticked by with the kind of desperate silence known only to the elderly. It is a silence underscored by loneliness and the knowledge that the good years are already in the past, coupled with the complications of old age itself. The body is not meant to survive nearly a century. I speak from experience when I say this. 2 years after Ruth died, I suffered a minor heart attack. I was barely able to dial for help before I fell to the floor unconscious. 2 years after that, it became difficult to maintain my balance, and I purchased the walker to keep from toppling into the rose bushes whenever I ventured outside. Caring for my father had taught me to expect these kinds of challenges, and I was largely able to move past them. What I hadn't expected, however, was the endless array of minor torments, little things, once so easy, now rendered impossible. I can no longer open a jar of jelly. I have the cashier at the supermarket do it before she slips it into the bag. My hand shakes so much that my penmanship is barely legible, which makes it difficult to pay the bills. I can read only in the brightest of lights, and without my dentures in place I can eat nothing but soup. Even at night, age is torturous. It takes forever for me to fall asleep, and prolonged slumber is a mirage. There is medicine, too. So many pills that I've had to tack a chart on the refrigerator to keep them straight. Medicine for arthritis and high blood pressure and high cholesterol. Some taken with food and some without. And I'm told that I must always carry nitroglycerin pills in my pocket in the event I ever again feel that searing pain in my chest. Before the cancer took root, a cancer that will gnaw at me until I'm nothing but skin and bones, I used to wonder what indignity the future would bring next. And God, in his wisdom, provided the answer. How about an accident? Let's break his bones and bury him in snow. I sometimes think God has an odd sense of humor. Had I said this to Ruth, she would not have laughed. She would say I should be thankful, for not everyone is blessed with a long life. She would have said that the accident was my fault. And then with a shrug, she would have explained that I had lived because our story was not yet finished. What became of me, and what will become of the collection? I spent 9 years answering these questions, and I think Ruth would have been pleased. I spent these years surrounded by Ruth's passion. I have spent my years embraced by her. Everywhere I have looked, I've been reminded of her. And before I go to bed every night, I stare at the painting above the fireplace, comforted by the knowledge that our story will have precisely the kind of ending that Ruth would have wanted. The sun rises higher, and I hurt even in the distant recesses of my body. My throat is parched, and all I want is to close my eyes and fade away. But Ruth will not let me. There is an intensity in her gaze that wills me to look at her. "It is worse now," she says, "the way you are feeling." "I'm just tired," I mumble. "Yes," she says, "but it is not your time yet. There is more you must tell me." I can barely make out her words. "Why?" "Because it is the story of us," she says, "and I want to hear about you." My mind spins again. The side of my face hurts where it presses against the steering wheel, and I notice that my broken arm looks bizarrely swollen. It has turned purple, and my fingers look like sausages. "You know how it ends." "I want to hear it, in your own words." "No," I say. "After sitting Shiva, the depression set in," she goes on, ignoring me. "You were very lonely. I did not want this for you." Sorrow has crept into her voice, and I close my eyes. "I couldn't help it," I say. "I missed you." She is silent for a moment. She knows I am being evasive. "Look at me, Ira. I want to see your eyes as you tell me what happened."
"I don't want to talk about this."
"Why not?" she persists. The ragged sound of my breath fills the car as I choose my words. "Because," I finally offer, "I'm ashamed."
"Because of what you did," she announces.
She knows the truth, and I nod, afraid of what she thinks of me. In time I hear her sigh.
"I was very worried about you," she finally says. "You would not eat after you sat Shiva, after everyone went away."
"I wasn't hungry."
"This is not true. You were hungry all the time. You chose to ignore it. You were starving yourself."
"It doesn't matter now," I falter.
"I want you to tell me the truth," she persists.
"I wanted to be with you."
"But what does that mean?" Too tired to argue, I finally open my eyes. It means, I say, that I was trying to die. It was the silence that did it. The silence that I still experience now. The silence that descended after the other mourners went away. At the time, I was not used to it. It was oppressive, suffocating, so quiet that it eventually became a roar that drowned out everything else. And slowly but surely, it leached me of my ability to care. Exhaustion and habits further conspired against me. At breakfast, I would pull out 2 cups for coffee instead of 1, and my throat would clench as I put the extra cup back in the cupboard. In the afternoon, I would call out that I was going out to retrieve the mail, only to realize that there was no one to answer me. My stomach felt permanently tense, and in the evenings I couldn't fathom the idea of cooking a dinner that I would have to eat alone. Days would pass where I ate nothing at all. I am no doctor. I do not know if the depression was clinical or simply a normal product of mourning, but the effect was the same. I did not see any reason to go on. I did not want to go on. But I was a coward, unwilling to take specific action. Instead, I took no action other than a refusal to eat much of anything. And again, the effect was the same. I lost weight and grew steadily weaker. My path preordained, and little by little my memories became jumbled. The realization that I was losing Ruth again made everything even worse, and soon I was eating nothing at all. Soon the summers we spent together vanished entirely, and I no longer saw any reason to fend off the inevitable. I began to spend most of my time in bed, eyes unfocused, as I gazed at the ceiling, the past and the future, a blank.
"I do not think this is true," she says. "You say that because you were depressed, you did not eat. You say that because you could not remember, you did not eat. But I think that it is because you did not eat that you could not remember. And so you did not have the strength to fight the depression."
"I was old," I say. "My strength had long since evaporated."
"You are making excuses now," she waves a hand. "But this is not a time to make jokes. I was very worried about you."
"You couldn't be worried. You weren't there. That was the problem." Her eyes narrow, and I know I've struck a nerve. She tilts her head, the morning sunlight casting half her face in shadow.
"Why do you say this?"
"Because it's true."
"Then how can I be here now?"
"Maybe you aren't."
"Ira."
She shakes her head. She talks to me the way I imagine she once talked to her students.
"Can you see me? Can you hear me?"
She leans forward, placing her hand on my own.
"Can you feel this?"
Her hand is warm and soft, hands I know even better than my own. "Yes," I say. "But I couldn't then." She smiles, looking satisfied, as if I just proved her point.
"That is because you were not eating."
A truth emerges in any long marriage, and the truth is this. Our spouses sometimes know us better than we even know ourselves. Ruth was no exception. She knew me. She knew how much I would miss her. She knew how much I needed to hear from her. She also knew that I, not she, would be the one left alone. It's the only explanation, and over the years I have never questioned it. If she made one mistake, it was that I did not discover what she had done until my cheeks had hollowed and my arms looked like twigs. I do not remember much about the day I made my discovery. The events have been lost to me. But this is not surprising. By that point, my days had become interchangeable, without meaning. And it wasn't until darkness set in that I found myself staring at the box of letters that sat upon Ruth's chest of drawers. I had seen them every night since her passing, but they were hers, not mine. And to my misguided way of thinking, I simply assumed they would make me feel worse. They would remind me of how much I missed her. They would remind me of all that I had lost. And the idea was unbearable. I just could not face it. And yet on that night, perhaps because I'd become numb to my feelings, I forced myself from the bed and retrieved the box. I wanted to remember again, if only for a single night, even if it hurt me. The box was strangely light, and when I lifted the lid I caught a whiff of the hand lotion Ruth had always used. It was faint, but it was there, and all at once my hands began to shake. But I was a man possessed, and I reached for the first of the anniversary letters I'd written her. The envelope was crisp and yellowing. I'd inscribed her name with the steadiness that had long since vanished, and once again I was reminded of my age. But I did not stop. Instead, I slid the brittle letter out of its sleeve as I maneuvered it into the light. At first the words were foreign to me, a stranger's words, and I did not recognize them. I paused and tried again, concentrating on bringing the words into focus. And as I did, I felt Ruth's presence gradually take shape beside me. "She is here," I thought to myself. "This is what she'd intended." My pulse began to race as I continued to read, the bedroom dissolving around me. Instead, I was back at the lake, in the thin mountain air of late summer. The college, shuttered and forlorn, stood in the background as Ruth read the letter, her downcast eyes flickering across the page. "I've brought you here, to the place where art first took on true meaning for me. And even though it will never be the same as it once was, this will always be our place. It's here that I was reminded of the reasons I fell in love with you. It was here where we began our new life together." When I finished the letter, I slipped it back into the envelope and set it aside. I read the second letter, then the next, then the one after that. The words flowed easily from one year to the next, and with them came memories of summers that in my depression I had been unable to recall. I paused when I read a passage that I'd written on our 16th anniversary. "I wish I had the talent to paint the way I feel about you, for my words always feel inadequate. I imagine using red for your passion and pale blue for your kindness, forest green to reflect the depth of your empathy, and bright yellow for your unflagging optimism. And still I wonder, can even an artist's palette capture the full range of what you mean to me?" Later I came across a letter I'd written in the midst of the dark years, after we'd learned that Daniel had moved away. "I witness your grief, and I don't know what to do, other than wish that I could somehow wash away the traces of your loss. I want more than anything to make things better, but in this I am helpless and have failed you. I'm sorry for this. As your husband, I can listen and hold you, and kiss your tears away, if given the chance." It went on, this lifetime in a box, one letter after another. Outside the window, the moon ascended and drifted and eventually climbed out of sight as I continued to read. Each letter echoed and reaffirmed my love for Ruth, burnished by our long years together. And Ruth, I learned, had loved me too, for she left me a gift at the bottom of the stack. I will admit I didn't expect this, That Ruth could still surprise me even from beyond caught me off guard. I stared at the letter lying at the bottom of the box, trying to imagine when she'd written it and why she'd never told me. I have read this letter often in the years since I first found it, so many times that I can recite it from memory. I know now that she kept it secret in the certainty that I would find it in the hour of my greatest need. She knew I would eventually read my letters to her. She predicted that a time would come when I could no longer resist the pull. And in the end, it worked out just as she'd planned. On that night, however, I did not think of this. I simply reached for the letter with trembling hands and slowly began to read.
My dearest Ira, I write this letter as you are sleeping in the bedroom, uncertain where I should begin. We both know why you're reading this letter and what it means, and I am sorry for what you must be enduring. Unlike you, I am not good at writing letters, and there is so much I want to say. Perhaps if I wrote in German, it might flow more easily, but then you could not read it. So what would be the point? I want to write you the kind of letter you always wrote to me. Sadly, unlike you, I have never been good with words, but I want to try. You deserve it, not just because you're my husband, but because of the man you are. I tell myself that I should begin with something romantic, a memory or gesture that captures the kind of husband you have been to me. The long weekend at the beach when we first made love, for example, or our honeymoon, when you presented me with 6 paintings. Or perhaps I should speak of the letters you wrote, or the feel of your gaze on me as I considered a particular piece of art. And yet, in truth, it is in the quiet details of our life together where I have found the most meaning. Your smile at breakfast always made my heart leap, and the moment in which you reached for my hand never failed to reassure me of the rightness of the world. So you see, choosing a handful of singular events feels wrong to me. Instead, I prefer to recall you in 100 different galleries and hotel rooms, to relive 1,000 small kisses and nights spent in the familiar comfort of each other's arms. Each of those memories deserves its own letter, for the way you made me feel in each and every instance. For this, I have loved you in return, more than you will ever know. I know you are struggling, and I am so sorry that I am not able to comfort you. It feels inconceivable that I will never be able to do so again. My plea to you is this: despite your sadness, do not forget how happy you have made me. Do not forget that I loved a man who loved me in return, and this was the greatest gift I could ever have hoped to receive. I am smiling as I write this, and I hope you can find it in yourself to smile as you read this. Do not drown yourself in grief. Instead, remember me with joy, for this is how I always thought of you. That is what I want more than anything. I want you to smile when you think of me, and in your smile I will live forever. I know you miss me terribly. I miss you too. But we still have each other, for I am, and always have been, part of you. You carry me in your heart, just as I carried you in mine, and nothing can ever change that. I love you, my darling, and you love me. Hold on to that feeling. Hold on to us. And little by little, you will find a way to heal. Ruth. You are thinking about the letter I wrote to you, Ruth says to me. My eyes flutter open, and I squint with weary effort, determined to bring her into focus. She is in her 60s, wisdom now deepening her beauty. There are small diamond studs in her ears, a gift I'd bought her when she retired.
I try and fail to wet my lips.
How do you know? I rasp.